Okay, good morning, everybody. We're back in the game. We're learning together, and today we're going to start learning about the wedding. That was funny because I was preparing and going through, getting ready into the zone of preparing for this topic. But it is so vast and it's so big. There's no possible way to do this in one session. So we said, okay, fine. So we got to the chuppah, and we'll see how far we can get, because this is so much. So we're going to break it into pieces. So within the crash course on the Jewish lifestyle, we're talking about getting to the chuppah. We want to acknowledge and thank our sponsors, Suri Stern, who is sponsoring the entire series and continued learning as well. In this particular moment, this particular session, I want to thank Dr. David Levy, who is sponsoring Lein Nishmas, Ruth Levy, Rus, Bas Miriam, Bas Kayla Lieber, who Kayla Lieber was the sister of Rav Menachem Gluskin, are based in Per?
Perchi, and later Petra.
Thank you. Aleha Shalom, this is David's mother's yard side to Mr. Hashem. Aleha Shalom, she should have a lichter gegan Eden. We're also going to be learning Lili Nishmas, Urchi Fish's father, Eliakim Getzel Fish. Thank you, Rosemary, for sponsoring. He was drafted into the Hungarian army. And he didn't even know that his wife was pregnant with Urchi Fish, and he perished in the Holocaust. But Baruch Hashem, even though he didn't know, he did have a legacy, and it continues today. Continues four generations after that now as well. V'chein yirbu. It shall continue for many, many years. You should be able to watch that continuation. So folks, let us learn a little bit of topics over here. So there's so many questions when it comes to this topic, and so many things that people don't know they should know. So let's start at the beginning of where to start over here. And it's always amazing to me is that, you know, like, so I try to make a point to meet with every person who's getting married in the shul. And just making sure that, you know, everything's under control and that people have a plan and so on and so forth. And it's amazing how few people realize how much they need to know, right? There's like, if people have a shul rabbi, right? So, and they've spoken to the shul rabbi, then usually they'll know a certain amount of things. But there's a lot of people who don't have shul rabbis, Nebach. And so they just, you know, they're floating around, and we'll get them, we'll figure it out. And it's like, there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to appreciate and to prepare for. And it's important to have a structure to know where we're going. Speaking of which, we're looking forward to a wedding. It's a shem. Looking forward to Abigail's wedding, Bezer Hashem, soon, God willing. And Mazal Tov to Robert and Rivka just on the engagement last week, Abigail. Abigail was my ninth grade student, apart from being an amazing person in the community, but I'm so, so proud about this, about her next stage. So Mitzvah Hashem, as we're in the topic of weddings, now we're in the topic of weddings. So a few things. Dates, when should we make weddings? So the truth is, this is mostly a practical consideration. People have lots of things. There's family who can be here, who cannot be here, the season, their expenses, seasons, right? And how much are we inconveniencing people? I remember there was a person not from Hashul, but I was schmoozing with somebody, and I said, oh, when's the wedding? And I said, oh, we're making it in the Meadowlands on Arrow Thanksgiving, and we're going to drag the whole five towns out there. I'm like, I was like, really? nonetheless, there are considerations. When it is, how expensive it is, what works for everybody. He's in school, she's in school, they've got jobs. There's all these considerations. That's the bulk of the considerations. Are there any other halachic considerations? The answer is yes. There are also other considerations. So for instance, there's days that a wedding cannot be. So a wedding should not be made on Yom Tov. It goes without saying, but it needs to be said. You know why? Because in the days where most Jews lived on the borderline of poverty, right, where most Jews were living in Eastern Europe as a disenfranchised minority with limited sources of profession, and in general, Eastern Europe was living on the breadline itself and still is for most people, then it would make a lot of sense to make a wedding on a Shabbos or Yom Tov. You know why? Because then you could actually make the Shabbos meal the wedding meal, because people were that poor. And so it has to be said, you can't make the Yom Tov meal, you can't make a wedding, you're not allowed to make it on Yom Tov, you're not allowed to make a wedding on Shabbos as well. Erev Yom Tov is also not allowed, so the Shulchan Aruch describes that Erev Yom Tov is also not allowed. This is going to lead to this as well, and I apologize. I really apologize. I'm going to have to take this call. I'm sorry. Everybody just hang. Sorry. Okay, let's continue. So we move back into the happy part times of life, and so the Erev Yom Tov also is not allowed as well. In this, but Erev Shabbos is allowed, and in fact, Erev Shabbos in fact was. This is a very interesting topic in and of itself. Is Erev Shabbos weddings? This also related to the idea of expenses as well, where people that have a wedding. And then they'll go into Shabbos, and that'd be the time where people would celebrate, and they'd make a bigger meal, and it'd be family and friends, and so on. So, and that was a practice which happened. There was a discussion as to, there was times where people were more concerned about it. There's a very famous incident in which the Ramah made a wedding, went into Shabbos, and then there was a ban on weddings Erev Shabbos. It's a very, very fascinating topic in and of itself. You should know that the Sfaradim are against this. The Ramah says weddings should not be made on Erev Shabbos or Motzei Shabbos, or Sunday, because it's going to be going to come to some degree of Chilul Shabbos. People are going to be preparing for it. But nonetheless, Erev Shabbos is allowed. And then there are other times which also should be not allowed as well. So for instance, during the Sfiras HaOmer, up till Lag BaOmer. So that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. And the Sfaradim say even after Lag BaOmer. So that would be, I'd say, a much more extensive time. Today, it's kind of like, you know, being whittled down on both sides, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if we have Sveika Diyam on either sides and have, like, you know, 15 days left. But nonetheless, people just do what they want today. Weddings whenever it's convenient. But from time immemorial, it was from Pesach to Lag BaOmer, there should not be weddings. Afterwards, including Lag BaOmer for Ashkenazim is all right. And then also, of course, the period between the 17th of Tammuz and the 9th of Av, and on minor fast days, especially the one that's talked about the most is Asara B'Teves, which is destruction related as well. Generally speaking, other fast days aren't part of that as well. There are days which have practically become days where weddings are not made. For instance, Aseret Yemei Teshuvah is seen as a time where there's supposed to be a certain gravitas. People are not supposed to be, you're not supposed to be like thinking about, you know, like this. It's too frivolous, too joyous to making a wedding during a time where everybody's supposed to be focused. And on Purim, interesting now, Hanukkah, yes, although it's really tough for everybody lighting candles, but when it comes to Purim, Purim has also been a day where people generally don't, although halakhically speaking, not technically, also in the same way as a Yom Tov. But there are days which are very good to make a wedding. So what is that? So if you look in Shulchan Aruch, Shulchan Aruch says an interesting thing, which you'd think sounds superstitious, and in fact, the poets can acknowledge and say it isn't superstitious, but it's best to make a wedding when the moon is waxing. Is that interesting? First half of the month. Who has made that consideration when making a wedding? Who, right? Very few people think about that. They just think when the day is, when the show rises, and who's going to fly in for what, right? But nonetheless, the Shulchan Aruch says best when the moon is waxing. It's a sign of growth. The Levana is Nimshala, the Yisrael Nimshala Levana is a time of growth as opposed to depletion, and it should be done as such. The exceptions to this are Elul Tishrei and Adar, just as an example. So this year we have 60 days of free rain in the Adar, so in terms of making this. And and some say this is, one doesn't need to consider this at all. So for instance, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch on this particular topic, or the Aruch HaShulchans talk about this, and they say, if there's the anchor better shall lamid bechisrona ela lesimon tov lamid b'milua mikoma kum yosef shul hakpid al mashe nema begmara. He says, so the Aruch HaShulchan says you don't have to be so makpid on this. Don't get like too, you know, hot under the collar for this. This is not worth it to do that. But if there's all things considered, and like it's an equal playing field, and one has a choice, between doing it the first half of the month, the second half of the Jewish month, you know, then do it the first half of the month. That's the point. But don't, like, you know, bend people out of shape, and, you know, make them a chutzpah and pay triple the price because of the tickets, because, you know, that's not what's being said over here. But all things equal, it's a better time to do things, is with the waxing of the moon. It is worthwhile knowing that there is a custom which I've heard, and very few people are adhere to this, but there are those who say that you shouldn't make a wedding during Elul. And the way that it's said in the yeshiva world is those who make a wedding during Elul either don't understand what a wedding is or don't understand what Elul is. Now, the truth is that, you know, like that comes from that very, you know, that sort of that intensity of what Elul is. I know incredible people who got married during Elul, and for a lot of people that's the time, because it's after the summer, people are coming back, it's around Labor Day time, right? And people are getting married, and that's And I know people in Israel, in the yeshiva world, who do this. So very, very fine people who do this. But nonetheless, there were people like that. Rav Wolbe is quoted as saying that, the Alei Shur. But nonetheless, just so people should be aware of, there are times more propitious, less propitious to do weddings. One should not make a fight about this, but it's a gezunt as well. What about days of the week? So which days of the week are best for making weddings? So Shabbos is out, right? So Shabbos is not a day for making weddings. But it is interesting that everybody knows about Tuesday, but Tuesday is the only day in Halacha which is not talked about. It's the only day which is not talked about. The best days the Gemara talks about is Wednesdays and Thursdays. That's the Gemara says, and that's quoted in Shulchan Aruch as well. These Thursdays is a very special time for weddings. In those days, actually, when the Ramah talks about it, he says that a lot of people, you know, when it comes to taking off work, what would happen is oftentimes the man who is generally the breadwinner, who had, like, you know, be out there doing what it was to float the boat, so he would be able to take off 2 days, and then it would make a weekend, you know, so it'd be 3 days of Shabbos, right? So it'd be like a little bit of time for the couple to settle down. You know, today we have a little more flexibility sometimes. You know, investment bankers excluded, you know, and doctors, like, but like the point is that there's a little more flexibility for time, and workplaces, generally speaking, are more understanding of these things. But the Ramah says that they would do weddings on the end of the week, and they have a little bit of time, they have a weekend. You know, there's also halachic reasons as well regarding Beis Din, but this is a time when people would do it sort of at the end of the week. It is interesting to note the Rambam writes that a wedding should not be on a Friday or a Sunday. It's going to end up sort of based on the Gemara. It's going to end up that something's going to start being prepared or end up being prepared because of Shabbos is going to lead to Chilul Shabbos. And today the practice of Rav Avadia Yosef in Israel is still paskins on Motzei Shabbos. It's not an appropriate time to do a wedding. And whenever there's Motzei Shabbos events, it gets very, very tight for caterers, for music, those kind of things. You know, something is going to give. Somebody's going to make it. We just brought them a little bit early, right? Right. So there's always going to be something that's going to happen. So it's better to avoid. Erev Shabbos was a long, very interesting debate over the centuries, but it seems to be a very time of bracha on Erev Shabbos as well, which is why some people do that. The Yemenite community actually bridges sometimes between Wednesday nights and Thursday nights. Chuppah Kiddushin, Kiddushin and Nisuin sometimes. Very interesting discussion. There is this notion about the Kitov twice, right, on Tuesdays. I've yet to see it inside that it doesn't mean to say it doesn't exist, but people love Tuesdays and it's a beautiful day and everything. But it isn't the days which are particularly talked about in Halacha as well. And again, when it comes to these things, Shalom is the name of the game. So if it's going to be that people are getting a little bit, you know, tight and taught about things, so do the day that works for everybody is fine. You know, that if one, I know sometimes people feel disappointed that, you know, the halls, there's so few halls, especially remember during COVID. I remember during COVID that somebody told me that the Rockley had been booked for every single night for 4 months in advance, every single night, right? I mean, like, there's only so many places, at least in our space, you know, believe me, there's more places, but in the spaces that people around here use, and there's limited space and limited nights, it becomes complicated. But if all things are equal, just some people say, oh, I'm disappointed it's a weeknight. It's like, no, sometimes a weeknight actually might be better in terms of the Jewish side of things, even though it means it's later. So that's just being aware of this as well. Where does it need to be? So a wedding can really practically be anywhere, you know, and I have Baruch Hashem, officiated a wedding at a zoo before. It was such a beautiful wedding. The Central Park Zoo was fantastic. Seals in the background. It was so good. It was the most wonderful wedding. But I've been to a wedding in a vineyard, out to 2 hours out in East Long Island. You know, weddings, if they can be somewhere, they will be somewhere. In fact, I remember if anybody's been down to Hell's Cavern, they've got Love Rock, you know, that's where people get married there. In fact, if you go to Pennsylvania, there's another cave over there, and one of their big highlights of this cave, I can't remember the name of this cavern, was like they managed to get like an entire grand piano piece by piece into the hall in the cave for the wedding. So if you can get married, I'm just surprised less marriages have happened at the base camp on Everest. Like, you know, like, it's just like, if you can do it, you go for it. But the truth is that there are a few limitations. So one of the interesting limitations is shuls, which is fascinating. So why shuls? Like, that's a really holy place. So it's true, but the practice of starting to make weddings in shuls became a practice which was as a function of the fact that Christians would get married in churches. And so therefore you'll see hesitation in the 1800s in Europe, where you'll see hesitation. The Chasam Sofer is very strong against making weddings in shuls, because it is reminiscent of the church custom of making weddings in churches, and we don't want it to be replicating what the culture is doing in that respect as well. And so for today, you'll see many people are concerned still about making a wedding in a shul, and although there are many who say it's not an issue. So this becomes a matter of debate. It's generally seen as all right, although there's some people who might bit on today. It becomes more complicated is what happens if the shul is conservative or reform. That becomes a complicated thing, because a lot of these beautiful campusi or halls are attached to these most magnificent shuls, and the shul will often serve as the chuppah room, and then you have the hall, which will be the feasting room and so on. So what do you do about that? So Rav Moshe Feinstein famously was asked about this. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked, are you allowed to attend such a wedding? He wasn't asking whether you should make such a wedding. He was asked whether you can attend such a wedding. And he goes through the halachas, because unfortunately, the premise that Rav Moshe Feinstein is working with is that if there are certain ikarim that are missing in a belief system, and ikar means to say not a mitzvah, but a axiom of faith. So if there's certain basic axioms about Judaism which are missing, then in a certain sense, that loses the term Judaism. That's the way that Rav Moshe works. And unfortunately, in certain sects of Judaism, those axioms have been negated. There's certain basic axioms which have been negated. Torah min ha-shamayim, nevuas Moshe, certain things which unfortunately are no longer tacit assumptions. And that therefore becomes actually not just we're called a diluted form of Judaism, but a corrupted form of Judaism. And that being the case, it's very hard to, one has to be very careful about acknowledging that as a, we'll call it side-by-side, acknowledgement, because that is not, I remember somebody once said to my father in the process when he was coming close to Judaism, they said, you can't call it tennis if you don't play by the rules of tennis, right? You can't say I'm playing tennis if there's no net. You can't say it's tennis if there's no outlines, right? That's a nice game, it's a good game, and it's probably very fun, but it's not tennis. So when it comes to Judaism as well, when certain things are missing, it becomes complicated, and therefore being in a place where there is, you sort of speak, it looks like a shul, and it's, people are acting like what it like is a shul, but there's something missing, could be complicated. And so Rav Moshe in the end of the day actually says, regarding this, he says, you know what? He says, there's no problem going to a hall as such. You are allowed to even enter the shul where such a chuppah is taking place, because it's clear it's not during the times of services. And there's no, he calls it Rabbi Reish Aleph Beis Yud. There's no rabbi who is there officiating of a different sect. He says, V'af, Shebeis HaKnesses Kosher, he says, anyway, there's a concern about shuls in general. This sanctuary doesn't have a sense of holiness, because unfortunately it hasn't, and it was not consecrated with the basic prerequisites. And it's all right to do that. He says, he says, it's not a good idea. I mean, technically speaking, it's all right, but one should be very careful about it. It's not the appropriate place to make weddings. That's what Rav Moshe says. And very famously, many, many people follow that. It should be noted, Rav Herschel Schachter points out that there's no concern today. Rav Herschel Schachter very famously says, there's no concern about this. One of the things that Rav Moshe also talks about in the Tshuva, when he talks about, when he was asked about this, is the concern is what's going to happen. What happens after every wedding? What do the men do? They daven Maariv or Mincha, depending what time of year it is, right? And where do you daven? You daven right where you are. But you should not be davening in such a sanctuary, right? You're not supposed to be davening in a sanctuary. In such a sanctuary, it's going to inevitably happen if it's going to be in the shul, the sanctuary, the temple, right? Whereas, so Rav Shechter feels, and it's not about the davening of mincha or not, But Rav Shechter feels that the game is lost. Unfortunately, the ship is left. There's nobody who's going from an Orthodox wedding, going to such a place who's going to be acknowledging, or they're just using the hall. They're just renting the facility. And so you'll see this divide that sometimes occurs between different groups today. This becomes a very contentious issue where people from the more right-wing world will say, we're absolutely not coming to such a wedding, or absolutely not accepting this, or the rabbi will say, I'm not going to be misdated condition in such a place. And in the world which abides by the psycho of Rav Shechter, it's really not so much of a concern. You'll see that divide, and it becomes complicated when you have families that have multiple members from different spaces, and then you start speaking together, and this one doesn't want to, and it becomes more complicated as well. Another factor to bear in mind as well is what some people will point out is what happens if when you pay the caterer is also paying the shul as well. So you're essentially paying money into this movement, which is there's a distance which is created, and so perhaps that's not the best arrangement as well. It depends on the financial arrangements with caterers and locations as well. This becomes unfortunately an unnecessarily contentious issue when it comes to preparing weddings. Eric, sorry, I kept on ignoring the question.
Timing, is it something more important than the time of the bride for the monthly thing?
Oh yes. I completely forgot to mention that. Absolutely. Thank you, Eric. You're right. 100%. So there is a hakpara that to avoid what's called a chupas nida. So we wanted to be in the... you're 100% right. I should have mentioned this first. Is you want to ensure that the wedding is going to be at the right time of month, that the kala and the chasana are allowed to be together. Right? So in order to do that, sometimes in the old days, they would have to reverse, and they would sort of have to project and say, okay, when should we make this wedding? That will be in tandem with the kala's cycle, right? So that's what would used to happen. Today it's less of an issue, because today we're the kala teacher in consultation with the OBGYN will put the kala on a medication track that will actually will shift the cycle to the necessary times. So today becomes less of a concern just because of manipulation. But generally speaking, that is a concern and has to be a discussion at the very beginning as well. Yes, so that's much more important than the first half of the month or the second half of the month as well in terms of the other passes. Thank you for reminding me about that point as well. So just in terms of the halls, shuls in general, a little bit of a concern. Conservative reform shuls, more of a concern today because of some of these considerations. There are those who are not concerned at all. There are those who are still somewhat concerned. And becomes a thing which unfortunately creates unnecessary machlokes. The goal of weddings is to create shalom. So one should just try to figure out, you know, how important to whom and so on. Is this really just an issue of trying to pacify as many people as possible? Is this an ideological issue? These are some of the things that need to be talked about as well. Another place that's important about placement is that the chuppah, generally speaking, should be outside. So tachas hashamayim, and there's many reasons is that the nation of Israel blessed to be like the kochvei hashamayim, to be like the stars of the heaven. Is now the element of this. Maybe perhaps we'll get this to next time. Is that the chuppah is meant to be a bias? It's meant to be a structure. So having a structure within a structure is not necessarily the way to go. I remember that when we were looking at wedding halls way back, and so we went to the Borough Park, circuit. And so in the Hasidic world, they very makbid on chuppahs being outside, very very makbid. And so like they were showing us this hall, and they were explaining that every sits inside during the winter, but the chos and the kala, they're outside by the door, right? You know, and it was like right next to like the BQE, like, you know. And so like we turned to the proprietor of the hall, and we said like, isn't it a little bit loud? I says, oh, it's the summer. Everybody goes to the country. Including everybody's going to work or coming back from work at 5 o'clock, you know, in Manhattan. All went up to the Catskills. But nonetheless,
wouldn't that resolve the issue of shuls? Because let's say you outside of, let's say, Temple Beth El.
Yes.
And you have
For sure. By the way, there's lots of creative solutions. For those who, like in the Westbury, you'll notice that the people, you know, a number of people make the, let's say it's in the summer times, they'll make the wedding in the beautiful gardens outside. And that's not just because of beauty, that's also because of this concern. And then the people will try to shift the bedekin room, and there's all kinds of things that can be done, and it's creative ways of doing things, and they'll be functional. But yeah, doing it outside would solve this issue. I know that in like some places in Brooklyn, they'll like make it in the street. The wedding will be in the street, the chuppah part will be in the street. Where I come from in South Africa, the chuppah and the actual the function would be separate occasions. So there would somebody's garden area, these large, huge gardens. And so in America called yards, but in outside it's called gardens. And so people have these beautiful gardens, and people would have the chuppah in gardens. And people would stand around, not seated like in America, or you'd stand around like in Israel, and these beautiful chuppahs outside. And then later on, people there would be a function, let's say 2 hours later, so everybody gets a chance to settle down. And the function, less people would be invited. So everybody would be invited to the chuppah, which would be one occasion, one space outside. And then, but again, when I was growing up, you had tropical climates, so you could do those kind of things. So it doesn't always work. We have much more intense. I remember somebody was describing to me a wedding in Switzerland, where they made in this hotel, and it was made in such a way, again, where they put the chuppah just outside, but it was snowing. It was snowing, and so the color was wearing a white fur coat. Can you imagine this? There's lots of different iterations of this expression. This does have value, and you'll notice, by the way, that most of the wedding halls you will go to have a skylight. You notice that, and so if you look at the sands, you look up above the chuppah, and you look at all these places, they have a skylight, and that's part of this. It's not exactly tachas hashamayim, but it's as close as we're getting inside. With everybody in a comfortable climate, but that is the function. That's the next wedding hall you go to. Look for that. Look for the skylight. There will almost inevitably be a skylight under the chuppah. I've even once saw one caterer shifting the chosnu color to make sure that under the skylight, under the chuppah. That far, I don't know if we go, but because it's usually a small skylight. But nonetheless, that's what it is as well. So another aspect that need to be planned beforehand as well. So a few aspects of this is. Want to do put myself back in my own thing over here. So a chasen and kala lessons. So it's important that a bride and groom attend sessions in which they learn about how to conduct themselves as a married couple with taharas mishpacha, and that requires time. So for a bride it can be at least 12 to 13 sessions, and for a boy at least 5 to 6. So if that's the case, then this is the kind of conversation that needs to happen earlier. So everybody's on the same page. And I used to not ask about these things, but then there was one occasion that a week before I got the call. It says, I've been listening to these shirim online, but there's like a few things I'm not clear on. And I'm like, we have a problem, Houston. So now I always ask towards the beginning, is there a chassan and kalad teacher? Do they speak to each other? Who are you going to be speaking to afterwards? Who are the questions they're going to be asking to afterwards? Set these things up. These are important that we arrive there with enough time. So if we're talking about 12 to 13 sessions, we talk about a weekly session, do the math. We talk about a few months, right? So this is required. Part of that as well is what's known typically as the chosen shmuz, the kala shmuz, which is not just the halacha, but also the appropriate hashkaf when it comes to intimacy as well. And you'll be surprised how many times that this is not included in those sessions as well. And if this is not included in these sessions, unfortunately, then the only education process is going to be those movies that we shouldn't have really been watching, right? And so if that's the case, that's not really how things work. And that's not how Judaism looks at things. So if that's the case, that somebody needs to sit down with a chassan and the kala and discuss that Judaism views intimacy in a very different way. And this should be perhaps a longer discussion and a book read together. But there's a lot that needs to be discussed because there's a lot of magical thinking about these things, and it's not necessarily the Jewish way of things. So this should also be included as well. Included in the conversations that also have to happen before the wedding is who's officiating the wedding, right? And that's what I was saying before, and it's important. If there's a shul rabbi, usually the shul rabbi who's responsible will sit down with the chasen and kala and do a number of sessions just to prepare and so on. For myself, if I have the opportunity of officiating at a wedding, I will sit down with all the parents and the chasen and the kala beforehand, 2 weeks out as well, just to make sure that we're all on the same page. And everybody says, no, we know, Rabbi, we've been to weddings. You may have been to weddings, and you may have even made weddings, but let me tell you, there's always going to be something. And it's good that if you walk through things, it'll bring up questions. When it brings up questions, we'll solve the questions. And you know what? We're not going to solve the problem when somebody's walking down the aisle. That's not the time to solve the problems. But then, unfortunately, there are a lot of times where people, there isn't a Masada Kedushin who's so aware of things. Sometimes you know, that you'll have a, you know, Rosh Shiva, all of a sudden you've flown in, and a lot of times I was once at a wedding, and he didn't know how to write a ksuba, right? You know, so I always have an extra ksuba in my car now, just because I learned this from a Rabbi Teitelbaum, when I go to weddings, you know, I have the emergency ksuba, or the emergency tznayim, because not every time you go to a wedding is the person proficient in officiating a wedding. And sometimes one has to step in to make sure that 2 hours later that we can actually figure things out, because they haven't yet successfully signed the tznayim, the ksuba. So these are the kind of things. It's important to have somebody who actually knows what they're doing, leading the wedding, and these are the kind of conversations that need to happen beforehand, so people are able to do this. These are some of the planning aspects of it as well. What about not seeing each other the week before the wedding? Okay, so this is an interesting discussion. It is not mentioned in the Mishnah, in the Gemara, in the Rishonim, and practically it's absent from the Achronim too. So this this custom. So there are those who try to talk about discuss this. So there are those who say that it may relate halachically to what's the notion of dam chimod, of perhaps we don't want to there to be a concern of nidus the week before the chuppah. It's very hard to substantiate that because it isn't talked about in early halacha. There is a notion Rabbi Forst in his two volume set on Hilchos Nidah does make the observation, and this is his quotation: although this custom is not halacha and has no early source in the poskim, it is a good custom because it gives the chassan and kala an opportunity to be alone and reflect upon the profound changes that are about to take place in their lives. That's a very valid point. And there's certainly something which is very, very profound about that space as well. Rabbi Ari Kaplan, in his book Made in Heaven on the topic of weddings, makes a note. He says, of course, if it is necessary for the wedding preparations or for other reasons, it is permitted for the couple to see each other. In some circles, the custom merely for them to not see each other on the day of the wedding. And so, like, you know, people have different practices, like text. Like, people ask me, Rabbi, is it halachically allowed to text each other? I'm like, there are many things we should be worried about. This is not the biggest worry, this one over here. There is a nice idea of separation. It is most likely, in all likelihood, is probably something which came from the non-Jewish world. There's a superstition in some sects in the non-Jewish world not to see each other before the wedding, or the night before, and so on. That's great and everything. There were some people who did so. Rav Moshe Feinstein was not makbid on this at all when he was asked about this. The story goes, Rav Notzer Greenblatt wanted to introduce his kala, but it was the week before, and Rav Moshe said, "What's the problem?" And there was cases where I saw Rav Zivotofsky has an article in which he quotes case where a chassan asked his Rav Soloveitchik, but the kala has no means to get to the wedding. He says, so you should drive her, right? So this is a very late day custom, and it's wonderful. It definitely has import. It definitely has psychological impact, but it should not be something which is going to get in the way. If there's certain planning things, if it's going to create more tension as well. Like, let's say there's a, God forbid, a machlokes which is brewing, right, between the families, and now they're in radio silence, right, and now it becomes more complicated. It's you know, I was once on Erev Shabbos, and the Erev Shabbos, the kala, the Shabbos kala, and the Ofrof, you know, speaking to the kala because the families weren't speaking to each other, and now they can't speak to the kala, and so they can't even help each other like that. In that case, right? So that should not be a thing. Don't go down that road, as well. Now, what about this business about not being alone on the day of the wedding? This does have halachic background, and this is the idea of having a shomer or a shomeres for both the man and the woman. And where does this come from? So it's actually a Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is describing how HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought Adam to Gan Eden Mikedem, and the marriage, so to speak, between the divine and humanity, which is a profound description. And it describes the way the Medrash describes it is, Voyumalach Yashoris Mahalchin Volchin Lifne Elefonov Kamoroin Amashamrim Esachupois. The Malach Asharis were escorting Adam like going to a chuppah, and it quotes the pasuk, "Ki Malachov yetzav elach lishmorcha b'chol drachecha." Your angels will accompany you. Tehillim Tzadi Aleph. Isn't it interesting? What is the context of that pasuk that we say that pasuk? It's always about. And so we say it at times of death or danger, and it's about protection. It's about protection. It's at the time of death, what we say in that pasuk is that beyond the beyond life, the malachim are going to accompany the soul. We say this as one of the tehillim which is said according to the chief rabbi right now in Israel about the soldiers. Ki malachav yitzav elach is the profound pasuk. So on that, Rav David Luria, who has a pirush on Pirkei Derabbi, as one of the earliest midrashim, says, yes, because at a time that a person is about to perform something which is really important, anytime we have a really important thing in life, then there's a kitrug. There's a danger of harm to that person. And when a person is about to get married, this is a profound change in their life. There's a certain kitrug, and that person needs protection, which is why they should be accompanied by somebody else 24 hours before their wedding. And that is the practice. Somebody is usually with the chasan and the kala throughout that process. That does have very early antecedents as well. Now, anything else that needs to be done for them before the wedding? So if the chasan and the kala have lost a parent, right? So in the situation where one of them has lost a parent, the minhag is that within the week of the wedding, if at all possible, to go to the grave to invite the deceased parent to the chuppah. Some people even go for grandparents as well. This is actually based on a very beautiful Zohar, which the Zohar says in such a beautiful quotation. Listen to this in the paragraph, I put in footnote 23. This time I decided to put all the sources in the footnotes for those who like to do it this way. But it says, "Va'ava gav da abba v'ima is parushu miha alma." This is in Aramaic. Even though the parents may have departed from this world, chedva bechol shutfasa havi. There is a unitedness at the time of chedva. What's chedva? Chedva is joy. It's one of the words we use for joy. When a person is being connected to the Almighty at a time of their great joy, Hashem enters the Garden of Eden. And Hashem escorts the parents who are also partners in your arriving here, and will bring them along to this moment. Isn't that beautiful, Zohar? So the practice has been to go to the grave and formally invite those who are no longer here. And then some Hasidic communities, they even take the invitation and put it by the kever as well, which is an interesting practice, which is to be found as well. But yes?
The whole going to the grave and talking to the dead.
Good question. Such a good question. So who do you talk to at graves is a good question. So in the more profoundly litvish community, it's very, very clear that you're only speaking to God at the grave. And why at the grave is because the grave is seen as a la'avdil, you'll apologize this example, but it's seen as a better hotspot. Right, a better Wi-Fi hotspot for Shechina, right? Where there are holy people who are buried, there is a more profound experience of Hashem there, which is why it's a better place to daven. That's generally the way that's understood in that world. But you should know in the Hasidic world, and there's more of a Kabbalistic notion that one is able to even talk to those who passed away as well. The practice is not during the first 12 months, by the way, that one should not daven. Or go there and speak to them, but after the first 12 months, there are many who daven and will speak to them and ask them to be a gutta better and so on. So there's, it just depends where one's bloodline comes from and where one is on the spectrum of rational or spiritual in Judaism. There's space for both, but yes, that comes to that. So you'll see that's why it's much more in the Hasidic practice in that, yes.
Do you say that the first 12 months after the person passes, we are supposed to stay away from the grave?
Generally speaking, unless it's the Shloshim or the Hakamas Matseva, that's generally speaking. Generally speaking, until there's a Hakamas Matseva,
yes,
that's where people avoid that.
Once the
Matseva
is there,
yeah, that's fine.
Go every day.
That's what some people do. But when one prays, one should not be praying for anything other than the good of the departed. The halacha is not for anything else. Not for anything else. Yeah. So that's just specifically at a time of din for them, which is the first 12 months. One should not be davening and saying, "Hakadosh Baruch Hu, look after the children." Afterwards is fine. Afterwards is fine.
You can pray for the soldiers and the poor. Like I just got a thing that 12 soldiers Friday were terribly injured.
Yep. But not during the first 12 months after Patira, because that person is going through their own process right now. Other things just to be aware of as well is do I need a fast? on the day of the wedding. And again, this is a custom which is in the Ashkenazi communities, right, Eric? I don't think it's as much in the Sephardic community. The fasting on the day of the chuppah. This seems to be an Ashkenazic practice, which is quoted in Halacha, and there's a number of reasons for this. One is the Ber Haitzav quotes two reasons. He says it's because the day of the wedding is a day of atonement, and it's like a Yom Kippur, and therefore on that day of atonement there's a fasting as one gets to that place. It's interesting to note that the Gemara talks about three people who get atonement. One is a king who's coronated, a person who was sick and is healed, and a person who is getting married. What is the parallel between all of those three? And the way I understood it is all these three people having expansion of consciousness, right? So a king is no longer Joe, he's King John, right? Now this now becomes a we. Whenever I say something on Twitter, people actually around the world notice it and it reflects our nation. So you have to be careful what you say as a representative of state. That's the expansion of consciousness. Then you have a person who's sick. When a person's sick, all the energy is focused inwards, right? They don't have the capacity to think beyond. It's very, very hard for a person when all the energy is about survival to be able to project outwards and see some amazing people who are able to. It's very, very uncommon for a person to be able to ask about how are you and how. It's very hard when all your energy is just about survival. When a person is healed, and they're able to have that energy to expand again, to be able to think broadly, to do broadly, to be out there, not just to get to the next day. And when a person gets married, they are no longer I, they are we. It's no longer you can just go out at night when you want and hang out with your friends. You don't just go without telling anybody what. No, you're a we. Your I has expanded. And in that expansion is a new sense of self, right? So your consciousness is now includes more, which means that at that change is an opportunity of mechila, and then reflected in that is the fast day. Another part of this is that it could also be, is that we want to set in tone, the right tone for this marriage. Is that this is the, you know, a marriage can be a physical engagement, right? And that's it. And that's what, if you look on the front pages of People magazine, you know, you go to your pharmacy and you see how long those marriages last. That's what it could be. That's a very low bar for what marriage is supposed to be. But if it's supposed to be bigger than that, then there's an emotional part to it. If there's an emotional part to it, that comes from having a focus on the spiritual emotions, not just about the physical. That's the case. So we start the wedding, where we're focusing a little more beyond than just physical. Yeah. Mikvah. Oh, what was that? Oh, mikvah, yes. So no, you're right. This is so mikvah usually happens 4 days before at least the wedding as well. And that has to be planned into that week beforehand as well. And in fact, some would say that part of the reason for the Chas and Kala not being together that week beforehand relates specifically to that as well. She may have gone to the mikvah, they're engaged, they really like each other. It's not a good time for them to be together. That's another possibility. Because there is another reason as to why it could be that there's no eating and drinking on the day of the wedding, and that is because of drunkenness. We don't want it to be that the chazan or kala, or probably the chazan, to enter the chuppah in a state of inebriation. And you say to yourself, well, like, who would do that? Well, like, check out what's happening in the world, folks. That's how people celebrate. Lots and lots of it. So that's not the way that we start our state. And so therefore, when does this fast day go till? Depends. If the wedding is, let's say, a Sunday wedding, right? So the wedding is like 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. It goes until after the chuppah. In the cheder yichud, they're able to eat, which is why there's usually food there. But if it's going to be a wedding, which let's say is in the winter, and the wedding's at 6 o'clock on a Monday night, then it says the kochavim is 4:30 or 4:45, whatever it is. Shkia's at 4:30. Tzeis is just after 5 o'clock. They can break the fast then already. They don't have to wait until the chuppah as well. But in such a case, they should not take l'chaims. The chas and the kala should not be taking l'chaims before the wedding. This is a time of gravitas, a time of things. Let me hang on for a moment. We don't want to take questions, but I do want to finish up as well. So just a few other things as well. That also means that because it's the time of Yom Kippur, then the chas and the kala should be doing vidui, and if they're fasting aneinu, like you're doing a private fast day, which is in the siddur, for a person who's saying a private fast day, and to be doing vidui like on Yom Kippur. Even if it's a day where they're not fasting, either because, let's say, they're not, if they're not going to do well, and fasting will mean to say she's going to get a migraine or he's going to collapse, don't fast, right? They should not fast in those cases, don't ruin the wedding for the fast. But, or let's say it's a day where you don't say tachanun, it's a Rosh Chodesh, it's Chanukah, it's Purim, you're not getting married, but let's say it's Chanukah, you're not supposed to be fasting on such a day, right? So if that's the case, and you're not fasting, you still do the vidui. You don't do the aneinu, because that's reflecting fasting, but you would do the other vidui. And this is amazing to me as well. I always tell the Chasna Kala, find a time before the wedding to make sure to daven, right? And bring with you a siddur, because guess what? The phone app doesn't have vidui. And I can't tell you how many weddings I've been at that they don't listen. And there we are at the chassan's tish, and the chassan's like, does anybody have a vidui? I'm like, really? Like, you're not going to be able to daven, do your vidui properly if you're surrounded by friends and a million people talking and eating. It doesn't work. So find a time earlier. If there's a mincha, you can get a minyan, great. If not, daven be a chiddush and do a proper aneinu and vidui, right? Take the time, bring a siddur, and do it properly.
If you're fasting, do you have to take it on the night before a mincha?
Good question. So technically speaking, if a person's able to do blinet, they should, yes. Like in the end of mincha, that little yiratzon, the person should absolutely say that, if they're able to do this. And of course, it's blinet, because let's say they're not feeling well. You know, again, you would just want to make sure that they're not locked in for that as well. And again, if somebody's not feeling well, or they know they don't feel well in these kind of situations, don't sacrifice the wedding for this custom. But in this case, hang on. Yes, you're right.
Just that Tu B'Shvat.
Yeah, Tu B'Shvat also.
When you get married, you looked it up and said, oh, it's Tu B'Shvat. You both don't have to fast.
Yeah, so Tu B'Shvat is another example of that. But it's not just a one-to-one rule. So for instance, let's say the month of Nisan, although there's no Tachanun, there's still fasting, right? So the Sheshes Me'agbala. The Shoshes Me'abala in the time before Sivan, there's no Tachanun, but there is fasting for weddings. So just, it isn't always clear, so you have to just check the specific dates. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch goes through all of them. Now, just so you know, as we get to the wedding, because I want to close over here. Oh, wow, we're really getting to the end of our time. So let's just quickly. Chasen's Tish. What happens at the Chasen's Tish? Most of the ladies don't really know, right? Except for moms for 2 seconds, right? So what goes on the Chasen's Tish? A lot of the legal documentation is signed. So Tanaim are signed. Ksuba is signed, wedding license, if it's done then. I usually do it later because I like to be the bride and the groom together. But the legal documentation is taken care of. And a lot of times it's the time for the chassan to share Torah, if able. On that note, and that you'll see a number of chassanim will make a siyum or say a divine Torah. And the practice is to interrupt the chassan. Part of that is just in case the chassan is not in a state to be able to say this, so he gets nervous. I was very nervous when I spoke at my chassan's tesh. And so people interrupt you to give you a little space. As well, I also saw that Rabbi Arya Kaplan talks about the notion that it's like the Shivrei Luchos. It's like the Torah being given. This is a Matan Torah experience. The Luchos being broken, so the speech is being broken, which is the kind of funny thing to include in a wedding. Rabbi Shraya talked about this yesterday at Surah Shlishis, and he said, yeah, well, the first Luchos were all like, you know, it was all there. There was no Yegiyah involved in the process. It just was. And the second luchos, after we'd failed, was where we had to put a lot of yegiyah, a lot of effort into learning the Torah. So he says, we remind ourselves about the shivrei luchos, when that marriage isn't just about like, wow, this is an amazing experience, thunder and lightning, and no. The real stuff is writing the luchos ourselves afterwards and figuring things out. That's being reminded in the chasm, being interrupted. So just an interesting observation I came across yesterday, Rabbi Kaplan quotes. Now, a few other things over here is the bedekan. So the bedekan, actually, the primary ceremony is not the chasen's tish. The chasen's tish is meant to be more humble in the corner, you know, the people just taking in the business and a little divrei Torah, maybe a little bit of singing. And that's what it should be. In the old days, it was always, you know, a little bit of cake and drinks, and that's what it was. Today, it's become a little more fancy. But even today, where's the good food? At the bedeka, because it's really about the kala at this point in time. In fact, the mission even talks about how they would have special chairs, like a throne for the kala to sit on, where she'd be greeted, her friends would come in front of her, give her greetings, even dance in front of her. It was primarily meant to be for women. And that's where the main feast is supposed to be music, and that's why it is. The bedeka is always much more of a beautiful affair. That's where it's really supposed to be at. And the kala comes in, she's like a queen, she sits on the throne, she's surrounded by family and friends. This is a very ancient custom. And there's a receiving line, because everybody's coming, everybody just wants to give and get brachas at this point in time. It's a very, very special time. The bedekin is called the bedekin because also it relates to the idea of the bride being veiled. So that being the case, the practice is that once everything's taken care of, the chasen's tish and the mincha's been done, and there's been a sufficient time for the kala to receive her friends and family, then the chasen is escorted with song. By the way, you'll notice that different communities have different song today. It's all very joyous. But if you go to some communities, where I grew up, it was a slower song. I don't know if you've ever seen this, where it's an escort. This is there's different practices. Alan Yekish Minag? Dirge, there you go. Right, so a slow song to escort the chasen to the kala. The primary point at this point, at least technically speaking, is for him to lower her veil, and then there's a number of brachas which are given. Fathers on both sides give brachas. Grandfathers on each side give brachas. If there's chashuvei ha'ir, great people should also give brachas at this point in time. And the question is like, why? What's the whole business over here? So one biblical precedent that is taken into account is when Rivka first saw Yitzchak, right? So as she saw him, she veiled herself. In Parashas Chayei Sarah. So at the very end over there, she veils herself. So there's this notion of as they come together, there's an element of modesty before they get married. There's an element of modesty which is reflected in this. That is one aspect of this. However, there's another halachic aspect which relates to the notion of nisuin, is that it's an intimate act for him to give her item of clothing, for him to clothe her in that respect. And that's seen as part of the process, the antecedent of the nisuim process, which is going to be happening later on. We'll get to that when we get to chuppah, because there's another two elements of this. This is one part of this, which is why you'll see sometimes, very infrequently, but sometimes you'll see that the officiant, the person who's doing the wedding, will be makbid that they're aiding for the bedekin. Very unusual, but as a function of that halachic aspect of it. I was once at a bedekin where the Masada Kedushin were not allowed to go forward until you found the Eidei Kedushin. Of course, we had the smorgasbord, you know, so it took a while to get that going. That should not be the way it goes. But nonetheless, you can appoint anybody for those. But that's as reflecting this. But the most profound perspective I heard was a perspective which goes as follows. Rabbi Jacobson was at our shul a couple of years ago, and he said the following observation. We all know that it goes down to a minag which comes from Yaakov Avinu, because what happens is Yaakov Avinu is getting married to Rachel, right? And then Vayuba Boika Vihine, Leah. It's not who he thought it was. So therefore, there's this veiling. But he says, but that doesn't really make sense, because, you know, it should be the opposite. It should be unveiling the kala. Who's really there? Especially in the Hasidic communities, the Chabad communities, the veil is opaque. In our communities, the veil is see-through. But in the Hasidic communities, it could be your mother-in-law you're marrying. You have no idea who's underneath that, right? Who's behind the veil, right? So you put the veil down. That's the opposite. So there's the observation that is the following, such a profound observation. And that is that a lot of people, they get married and they're like looking at they're in their ideal years. They're strong, they're vibrant, they're good looking, they haven't uncovered all the baggage of their childhood yet, right? And like, you know, so they get married, it's amazing. And then fast forward a number of years, and there's kids, and it's complex, and the athletic bodies on both sides is no longer quite as athletic, and all the idiosyncrasies have come out, and all the baggage has come out, and they've worked together profoundly, and 20 years later, they wake up, it reminds me of Tevye in the Fiddle on the Roof. And like, you know, after all his daughters are talking about love, he turns to his wife and he says, Golda, do you love me? Do you remember this? And she said, and the song is, and she says, I've made your beds, and I raised your kids, and I looked after your house. I guess we call that love. Right, so the point is that over here, you wake up later on and you say, so the observation is like this, is that when you marry a person, commitment doesn't mean to say marrying the image you're looking at right now, both ways. It means marrying every iteration of this person that they will become, and you will grow with them. Which means I'm not marrying who you are now. I'm marrying who you will become. That's the veiling. Is that what real commitment is? If commitment was just when it looks nice to me, that's a very self-serving kind of marriage, isn't that? That's not what marriage is. And marriage is at the bedside in sometimes the most complicated situations. Marriage is when the other person is incredibly vulnerable. That's all part of the veil as well. That's part of the bedekin as well. So that's part of it as well. Finally, being as it dates back to the times of Rivka as well, there is a bracha besides the bracha that a father would give a daughter on a Friday night, if that's the custom. There's also a bracha which was given to Rivka as she gets married, which is Achoseinu at Hayil Alfei Revavavi Rash Zarech Sonov, which is a bracha given to Rivka by her mother at the time when she's getting married. Why not her father? He's dead, right? But Rivka, when she's given that's why it's Achoteinu, it's Lavon and the mother of Rivka, giving the bracha to Rivka as she goes into chuppah, and this is also the custom to be said as well. You say, what happens to the moms? Well, the moms give the bracha before and after. The bedekin part is where it's sort of the public thing. But then when they recede before the chuppah, that's the time where the parents give the special brachas to their children privately as well. And that's a very special moment before the chuppah, which takes us to the moment now of the chuppah. And so there's so much more to talk about, as you can see. This is just getting to the chuppah. Now when we get to the chuppah, there's a lot of incredible practices, but it's a shame we will unpack them in the next time. Thank you so much for your time.